This week on the Vergecast, we go over the latest in coronavirus news. We talk about the iPhone SE review, the Magic Keyboard for iPad Pro review, touch a little bit on the future of Apple's processors for the Mac. We hear there's an ARM processor coming. Then we get into the future of Wi-Fi with Wi-Fi 6E, and talk a little bit about the streaming wars. That's coming up on the Vergecast.
Support for the Vergecast comes from Wix Studio. Wix Studio is an end-to-end web platform that gives agencies and enterprises the total creative freedom to design, develop, and deliver the way they want, and do it all with maximum efficiency. And the feeling you get from creative freedom isn't something money can buy. If you want creative reign in your next project, Wix Studio wants to give you the freedom and tools to do just that. Check it out for yourself.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello and welcome to the Vergecast, the flagship podcast of our current situation. I prepared for that one. I thought about it beforehand. I'm Neil. I'm your friend. Dieter Bohn is here.
I was really hoping you were going for an electricity joke there with current situation.
Ooh, it's shocking. Paul Miller is here.
Hello. I'm relieved that you weren't going for an electricity joke.
I should just start calling you guys like lightning and thunder. Which one of you would be lightning and thunder? Which one would be thunder? Ooh. Paul, I hate to say, I think you're thunder.
Okay, I'm fine with that.
I mean, they're both cool, so there's no
I'm warning of the... thunder.
It's the other way around.
I'm still finding my place in the world.
It's a warning that comes several seconds afterwards. That's great. We definitely know how weather works.
A delayed warning.
Welcome to the Vergecast, a show where we explain lightning and thunder to each other. A lot going on this week. Dieter reviewed not one, but two pretty important Apple products, the iPhone SE 2020, the Magic Keyboard. There's some big rumors about what they might be doing with chips. You got some other phones going. There's actually shockingly huge Wi-Fi news that we got to talk about.
Yeah.
There's earnings season is in full effect, which in the time of virus is very interesting. We're learning a lot, particularly the streaming companies are telling us what's going on. So a lot to talk about. But per feedback from you, the audience, I want to start and make sure we call out some of the great coverage on the site about both the coronavirus, how we're dealing with it, and then the second order effects that basically worldwide isolation orders are having, which are quite frankly fascinating. So I got to say it. The show comes out on Fridays. Six weeks ago, President Donald Trump held up a flow chart. Well, actually, I think Dr. Deborah Birx held up the flow chart, but Trump was standing next to the flow chart, promising a website that you would do a symptom check on, and then you would schedule a test in a parking lot of a major American retailer. You would drive through, you'd get tested, and then the website would tell you your results. I know that that's what the promise was because, again, it was printed on a flow chart.
Yeah.
The other side of the flow chart, by the way, was that the symptom checker determined you didn't need a test. It was just like, you're good. Mm-hmm. I don't know why it needed to be a flow chart, but so goes.
I think it's a nice subtlety of the announcement was there's like a dig on, like, unlike some websites, this website will be done very soon. Referring to, of course, the infamous health.
Yeah, the Obamacare website. The man can't resist a dig at Obama, which is, I mean, whatever. We're all the people we're going to be.
I was hoping it was going to turn into a dig on Squarespace, but it didn't go there.
Yeah, he was like, have you tried Wix? It blows. I don't know. Wix is great. Whatever.
I have a question about this. Imagine, I don't actually know any inside information here, but imagine that Google actually is working on this website that was promised. Like, imagine they actually were. They would be stupid to tell anybody, because if they hinted at it, somebody would also hint to it to Donald Trump, and then he would go out there and make another big unsupported promise.
Yeah. Like,
if they are, in fact, working on it, they kind of like can't tell us.
Well, it's been 6 weeks. No federal website of that caliber has been revealed, whether or not Google has I believe it was 17,000 engineers were working on it. It seems doubtful.
It goes up by an order of magnitude every
Maybe
time.
Maybe the site is live, but it's built by the Gmail team, so it's just still loading.
It's still, yeah. If you type command and then test really fast in Gmail, it actually opens. It's Easter egg. Anyway, site doesn't exist. We're just going to keep tracking on it because it's a pretty enormous promise. However, a bunch of other stuff is happening more positively. Google is now listing COVID-19 testing centers in search results. So we are developing the capability to know where those centers are, to track them as other map locations. So Google's telling people, if you're searching, where some of those places are. This one is just... the president leads to there's a style of thing you can do with the president that we generally don't do, which is he tweets something and then we have to go and ask everybody what they think of a tweet. The Verge basically doesn't do this. And I will tell you that Casey Newton thinks this is the dumbest story, like the dumbest story to pursue. Like imagine Casey, imagine his voice and then imagine him saying, you want me to ask them what they think of a tweet? So then we don't do it because Casey's right.
I feel judged right now.
Yeah, it's like that's the correct decision. However, Trump announced that a bunch of CEOs would join his councils to reopen the economy. This was also rolled out in somewhat symbolic fashion. Many of the CEOs didn't even know they were going to be listed. But then, like the next day, Trump is tweeting, liberate Michigan, liberate Minnesota.
I love it.
Which is...
rise up.
Yeah, rise up against...
Secede every state, 50 separate states. I'm sick of this federal... Anyways, go on.
No, I understand what you're saying. the country is called the United States.
That's right.
Perhaps there's another sort of arrangement of those states. Warring states, disunited
states. Socially distant states.
Socially distant states. Anyhow, Trump is tweeting liberate Michigan. So we actually... I mean, this was in such close proximity to announcing these councils. We went out and asked all the CEOs in our zones, car company CEOs, tech company CEOs, biotech company CEOs, do you support this rhetoric, right? You're on this council to figure out how to reopen the economy. Unsurprisingly, every single CEO declined to comment, just flat declined to comment. And I will just offer you this, which I think is important. One major company's PR person, who would issue this comment, literally responded when I showed him the tweet, my God. And he was like, no comment. And then another major, major company, PR person that we usually, the person we go through to talk to the CEO, just said, I wasn't aware we were on the council, which is brutal. And like this person would know. And then declined to comment. So that's, I think there's a little bit of that happening. We're kind of tracking what those councils are going to do, what the big tech companies, the big car companies are going to be involved in it, because it's interesting. Third thing I want to call out, you've probably seen this around if you're paying attention to tech. Bill Gates has become this villain, this like conspiracy theorist villain. He's involved in these absolutely wild conspiracy theories that he did the coronavirus. I keep waiting for him to write like the Washington Post or New York Times editorial with the headline that's like Bill Gates : I didn't do coronavirus.
Oh my God.
But there's just a wild set of conspiracy theories around him. We're tracking some of that stuff. Addie Robertson is paying attention to that stuff. But next to that, Gates is spending a lot of money. He's investing a lot of money into vaccine research development. And he put out a long letter today on his own site, Gates Notes, basically saying how he thinks it's going to go. And what's notable about it, the reason I want to talk about it is he's like, this is going to be a manual process. Interviews, databases, all this automated contact tracing technology stuff we're talking about. It's great. It will be great for some people, but the way to really do it is to staff up and go and do it, boots on the ground. So that's a little bit of a split. Obviously, Apple and Google are building contact tracing capabilities into their operating systems. You've got Gates kind of next to it saying, still need some old-fashioned shoe leather, go talk to people, keep track of things. So, yeah.
Although I think if you talk to Apple and Google, they'd probably agree with that. It's unclear. I mean, we have to wait for the stuff to actually start rolling out for real from on iOS and Android, in the two phases.
And that's, I think we're looking at that in May. So we'll surely know more soon.
And then the other thing to just say about Bill Gates, I mean, the conspiracy theory stuff is just awful on like so many levels. But he's also been banging the drum pretty hard that, even if the best case scenario vaccine timeline happens, we are not going to be prepared to actually mass produce it. So he has been like thinking very pragmatically about the need to like ramp up, you know, our capability to produce vaccines en masse because we're not there yet, just to like get ready for if the vaccine actually happens. So in general, I think that there's, you know, there's a whole lot of discussion about what should billionaires be doing in terms of philanthropy and what's the role of that and oversight and blah, 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 blah. And that's all like a super valid discussion to have. But like in this moment, Bill Gates seems to be doing like the right things in terms of like being a public intellectual and like staying in his lane, not over, and just like he's doing some like good work here.
Yeah, I think his big quote is, we're going to build 7 factories to make 7 different kinds of vaccines. One will be correct. The rest will be a waste, but it is the right kind of waste.
Yeah.
Like, right. That's like, you have to have Bill Gates's money and brain to have that idea and then to implement it. I think it is ridiculous that he has come out. He has become the center of the conspiracy theory. First of all, it is historically not hard to get Bill Gates to talk about pandemics. I've interviewed him. Ezra's interviewed him. Casey's talked to him. It's like a hop, skip, and a jump from like, what did you eat for breakfast today? To I'm worried about global pandemics. With like, he's ready to talk about it. Like, that's the scale of the challenge he is focused on, much to his credit. And I think the idea that because he's been paying attention to it and warning people about it means that he did it just represents like a deep stupidity. There's no other way for me to react to that. So it's out there. We're tracking it. We know our audience is interested in Bill Gates and his many doings. So we're tracking what he's doing, and we're also tracking the misinformation side of it. Some other stuff that's going on. This is just my favorite thing. There's a Connecticut suburb that has deployed pandemic drones to try to enforce social distancing. So they're just flying drones around to get people out of the parks. That's pretty good.
Drones don't have that long a battery life? I'm very confused by this. Like, maybe they've got special drones that can like stay in the air for hours at a time, but most drones, consumer drones, like that a city has access to, I have to assume can't.
Well, maybe they could have bought the bigger ones, you know?
Maybe.
Anyway, it's just very entertaining. It's like, we're going to see uses of technology like this. Another one along these lines.
Is it entertaining? Is it incredibly creepy? Also, these are like, they like detect heat. Like they're doing like a low grade diagnosis of people with these drones, as far as I can understand.
I think the company, which is called Dragonfly, is making a lot of claims. I don't know that all of the features are being used, but we've seen these drones, similar ideas have been used in China. I think I've seen some similar reports out of South Korea. The idea that you need to like monitor these places where you're going to have gatherings and tell people to go home. You can either do it with police, or I guess you could do it with flying robots with IR cameras. Well, I mean, it's like one little test in one little Connecticut town, but it's certainly starting to happen. Similarly, Boston Dynamics, the Spot robot, helping hospitals remotely treat coronavirus patients. This is another in the how do we get you the assistance you need without endangering our frontline workers. Very cool. And then just a bunch of like the second order stuff that I was talking about. Zoe Schiffer wrote a great story about courts holding their trials over Zoom, which is happening all over the place. My wife, Becky, actually had a hearing over Skype for Business today in the New York court system. I've got my lawyer friends in Wisconsin. They're doing trials over Zoom. Zoe talked to judges in California who are doing trials over Zoom. She also uncovered a letter from a judge in Florida who had to sternly warn the lawyers in his court, please dress appropriately. After Ooh. a lawyer showed up wearing no shirt, and another lawyer showed up in a swimsuit, and he had to remind them that like a beach cover up does not hide the fact that you're on the beach. So a lot of that's sort of a second order effects. A big question that Zoe has been asking, if you're out there and you know the answer to this, unclear what's going to happen with jury trials, right? So this is a lot of motion hearings, a lot of summary judgment hearings, a lot of procedural stuff is happening over Zoom. You can do that, right? That's usually just a judge and the lawyers. You need to seat a jury and you're doing it over Zoom. You've got like big problems.
Yeah.
So there's some positive sides of this, those hearings and stuff. For example, Wisconsin is streaming all of that stuff over YouTube to make it open to the public. That's cool. Oh, wow. Like, that's a neat kind of like outcome of this. You add a jury to this mix. People can see the jury. The jury can record the stuff. Like, ooh, big, big questions as this continues. So if you're out there and you're working on this stuff, hit me up, hit Zoe up. It's something, it's the next turn of the story we're really into. Ashley Carman interviewed the CEO of an app called Marco Polo, which has been around forever. It is basically a Snapchat clone, but now it's blowing up. It just rocketed up the app charts. A lot of rhetoric about how they don't do ads, how they don't sell your data. They have a little premium tier you can pay for. Little quote in there, they're like, we're not end-to-end encrypted. It's not encrypted on the server because if you lose your phone, we want to back your stuff up, which is just not my understanding of.
Do you know the verb for Marco Poloing? Like if I want you to hit me up on Marco Polo, do I say, hey, Marco me?
Yeah. And then a reply is a polo. I mean, obviously.
Right. You're like Marco. And then Dieter's like Polo. And then
okay.
Like,
I get it. Instant,
right. Have you never played Marco? Have you never been a child in a pool?
No, I was just checking it.
Julia Alexander wrote about YouTube channels that are exploding lo-fi beats to quarantine to. Talk to a number of those channel operators. This is just like a phenomenon that's been going for years, but now it's exploding. It's basically YouTube channels that play very chill beats. Interesting part of this, the chats of those channels have become little communities of people who are like lonely and scared during the quarantine. So they show up to like listen to this chill music to work to, and then they end up chatting and having a community. That's like my favorite kind of Verge story, right? It's like, it's a mixture of all of the things, and what you end up with it is like a little community of people supporting each other. Love it. Check out that story. And then last two, just kind of most directly related to the virus, how we're tweeting it. The first at-home COVID-19 testing kit was authorized by the FDA. It's a box. They mail it to you. You swab yourself. You put the swab back in the box. You mail it back to them. It costs $119. Guess what it's called? It's called the Pixel.
No.
Sure is.
And it's like, but it works, right? Like,
we don't know. All this stuff has been approved by the FDA under an emergency title. So,
and my understanding is this test is going to health workers first.
It will go to health workers first. I think what's interesting about the reason we wanted to cover it is obviously packaged, marketed, produced, priced like a consumer product.
Right.
If you wait for the A series, it'll be a lot cheaper.
It'll be a little cheaper, just good. I'll have a headphone jack. And then Nicole also wrote about this new trend, which is people using apps that use your camera or like your smartwatch or whatever to measure your blood oxygen level. There's a lot of chatter about blood oxygen level being an indicator of COVID infections. Don't do that is basically the thrust of her story. There's a lot of this stuff out there, but it's not nearly as reliable as it should be. So if you're hearing about it, check out Nicole's story. It's really thorough, as all of Nicole's stories are. I know it's very tempting, especially because it's very hard to buy a thermometer right now. But read the story, because this is the sort of thing tech companies want to do, right? There's like rumors that like the next Apple Watch will be able to do pulse ox, right? There's like Fitbits can already do it, but it needs to be calibrated. It needs to be accurate. It needs to work in the situation. And that stuff, those loops haven't been closed for this particular use. And I think that's one of those things with consumer tech in particular. Usually when you use a piece of consumer tech for something it's not designed for, you're like, well, you know, that kind of works. Like, I hacked it to make it do this thing. This is like, it needs to be calibrated to read the thing correctly to give you the scientific result that you're looking for. And that's a big split.
And the studies that she cites specifically say they're giving back your normal readings for people that may not be normal, which is incredibly dangerous. I have to wonder, you know, as these apps get more publicity, like how much longer are they going to stay live in the app stores?
Oh, the ones that like to use the camera to look at your finger or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that stuff just seems real dicey to me. So read that story. If you see people using this stuff, share that story. Nicole is just very thorough. That story is great. Okay. It's the virus. Do we miss any big virus stories? I don't think we did. 6 weeks. If you're one of the 17,000 Google engineers.
I think it's 1,700.
If you're one of the 45 million Google engineers working on this website, you just let me know. We're dying to hear from you. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back, talk about this iPhone.
Support for the Vergecast comes from Wix Studio. Wix Studio is an end-to-end web platform that gives agencies and enterprises the creative freedom to design, develop, and deliver exactly the way they want, and do it all with maximum efficiency. Look, we've only got a minute to tell you about them, so why not share a few things you can do from start to finish in a minute or less on Wix Studio? You can adapt your designs for every device with responsive AI, or jump seamlessly between front-end and back-end, or generate code and troubleshoot bugs with a built-in AI code assistant. You can switch up the styling of hundreds of web pages. That means fonts, layouts, colors, all in one click. You can also add no-code animations and gradient backgrounds right in the editor, or reuse full-stack apps and UI components across multiple sites and projects. And one more big one. You can package and deliver everything your client needs in one smooth handover. And we're at time, but you can step into Wix Studio to give all that a shot yourself.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume. Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Dieter Bohn.
Hi.
I feel like usually when we review an iPhone, there's like all kinds of pomp and circumstance. Like, it was an iPhone review week.
Yeah, I will tell the world that there seems to be slightly more interest in the Magic Keyboard from our audience than in the iPhone SE.
I mean, I get it. It's a bunch of parts we've reviewed already.
The parts are, this isn't ultra confirmed. We talked about this last week, but iPhone XR camera, it is the iPhone 11 processor, and everything else is iPhone 8, like the end. But they didn't screw any of it up, right? And the camera in particular is really fascinating because in decent light, it is almost indistinguishable from an iPhone 11 Pro. I can see it. You can zoom in and see it. This isn't like, oh, all cameras are good in bright light. Like, it's genuinely good in bright light. And it is genuinely terrible in low light, in dim light. Like, there's no night mode, but on top of there being no night mode, it is just noisy as hell. And I have gotten decent dim, dark shots from time to time, but it's so unpredictable and you will get garbage so often that it's bad. Like, you just cannot trust it to like give you something that you're going to want to use when it's a little bit dark out.
We should back up and start with the phone, because I feel like I could start going in on this camera.
Yeah.
And my many conspiracy theories about the camera forever. But when you say it's an iPhone 8, like, same home button, same Touch ID, same display.
Haptic feedback, the long, whatever they're calling their long press haptics now. Same, like, there's no actual physical home button. You like press it, the thing taps back at you, and that's the physicalness of the home button. Same battery life, honestly. Like, the battery life is like a day-ish. If you push it hard, you make it less, but I think most people end up with a day. It's like pretty good, but it is not as good as the iPhone XR or the iPhone 11 or the iPhone 11 Pro. Now, a lot of their batteries come from just having bigger batteries than this one does. And I was kind of hoping they maybe came from the A13, but no.
You just said it has haptic. It does the long press, right?
Yeah.
The iPhone 8 had 3D touch.
Oh yeah. They yanked 3D touch.
Did they put a bigger battery in?
Uncleared. Apple will never tell you what the milliamps are. We got to wait for the teardown.
Because the thing that gets me is like that gives you extra space.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because the battery life is not spectacular here.
It's not spectacular. And like the only reason I'm like pretty nervous about it, like it's a full day. Like, don't get me wrong. If you want to buy a phone for less than $500, buy this phone. It is very good. And the battery life is like good. It's fine. It's just not like, oh, this is great. This is like, because in 2020, it was the year where we're like, oh, wait, we can get phones that actually last a day for real, not for pretend. Hooray. And this phone is not up to that spec. It's a day, but like, it's not like, oh, definitely a day. And the only reason I like think it's worth thinking about is I think that this phone, more so than maybe even like the high-end phones, you buy and you expect to hang on to for 3, 4, 5 years, right? People that buy the SE, like bought the original SE, like hung on to that thing because it was small and they loved it. And we all know that like the iPhone 6, 6S, 7, 8, those batteries eventually like wear out and you need to get them replaced. It's not that hard to replace a battery in that series. It's a pretty known thing to do because they've been around for so long. But you should maybe anticipate that if you buy this phone in 2 or 3 years, you aren't going to be thinking about replacing the battery on it.
Yeah. You just said that, I think, the crux of it, which is if this is the amount of money you have to spend, you should buy this phone. Like, no further questions need be asked. Like, it's this one. And I think it's just so the conversation between this basically being the parts bin phone. Like, here's a bunch of parts Apple can get for cheap or is already invested in and they have the tooling and blah, blah, blah. And then, like, what other cheap phones are. Like, I'm going to use this word and you tell me if it's wrong. Like, for $400, this phone is, like, fairly respectful. Like, it's as nice as every other iPhone ever was.
Oh, sure.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
But for $400, if you go to any other phone, you end up with a bunch of plastic or gaps or weird compromises in screens
or build quality or whatever. Yeah.
Right. And I think one of the questions here is like, and this is pretty unique because of Apple's scale and its strategy of using this particular case for a billion years. Would you rather have the best of the older technology or slightly worse modern technology? Like, would you rather have a bad 120 hertz screen or a great 60 hertz screen? Right. Like, that's kind of like the split that's happening. Right. Would you rather have this phone with its, you know, 2x2 gigabit LTE radio or a pretty flaky, unreliable, cheapo media tech 5G radio that might light on fire? Like, whatever those splits are, they're in here.
That might be a little bit of a false dichotomy. I mean, the Asus Zenfone last year with its weird flippy camera was pretty solid. The Pixel 3a, you know, slow. Like, there are trade-offs on the Android side more so than on the iPhone side. But there are trade-offs on the iPhone side. Like, all of those Android phones, the 4a that's coming up, are going to have much smaller bezels. And I get why the bezels are here, because it means that they can just use the same damn factory they've been using for more than half a decade. Right. And so that just that's what allows this to be iPhone quality, top quality stuff, last year's best at $400. But I don't know. That's sort of like Apple's factories are not my problem. You know, they managed to make Android phones for like less money. And I don't know. I don't want to say it's impossible to have like redesigned this thing to be a little bit smaller so that there's a better screen to body ratio. Maybe it would have been. And I think that, like, it's okay to say that, like, maybe Apple could have done it and they chose not to.
They could have done it and they could have, like, maybe accepted less of a profit margin on it, right? Like, Apple holds its margins really. But there's just not another category of thing or even any other company that even, like, does it this way where it's like, we've remixed a bunch of last year's stuff, put in this year's chip, and now it's cheaper, right? Like, you can't go out and buy a car. You can't be like, I would like to buy a Mustang, a 1965 Mustang with a 2020 engine for $10,000. Like,
yeah.
It's just not a choice you can make. Like, yeah, like, there are guys out there who will, like, build that car for you for, like, $150,000. But that's not, like, a thing that Ford offers, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't exist with laptops, right? Processor bump laptops occur, but they just stay there in price. This particular price curve against the design of the phone, it feels to be like wholly unique in terms of a product category.
Well, and it's unique in the same way that's parallel to the iPhone being unique as a like consumer product in terms of its scale, right? Like, what other thing can you go buy that is made that they make as many of them as they do at the iPhone at like the iPhone's level of like price and sophistication?
Yeah, it's like not many things. Like, I feel like it would be great to roll into a Mercedes dealership and be like, that, you know, that S-Class from 3 years ago looked great. Can I have completely modern internals and roll away?
Is this the slowest processor that Apple makes now?
No, they still are producing new devices with the A12. So the A12Z is on the new iPad Pro, for example.
Oh, right.
And, you know, there's like cores versus gigahertz versus the, you know, onboard GPU, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, but they're like straightforward, actually coming off of Apple's line. Because like, I wonder if it was the sort of thing where it's like, well, you know, we want to wind down old processor factories to, you know, we want to free up those lines. Like, obviously, they don't manufacture their chips, as far as I understand. They just design them. But mm-hmm. we want to free up that capacity to retool for whatever's coming next. A14 for Max. And and so, you know, let, you know, we don't have a budget processor to put in this thing. Because that's what's so astonishing about this phone. Like, there are lots of amazing budget Android phones, but they don't have the 865 in them.
Right. Like Samsung, for example, there's like the S10 Lite, there's like the A series, and there's like, you know, 50 of them that come out every year. the A series actually sells better than the S series worldwide. We haven't paid a lot of attention to because they haven't made a big push to sell them here in the US, but I think that might change this year.
Didn't they do that one insane ad that was like, that had the song?
Yes, I know. I can't remember the song, but I know the ad you're thinking about because I watched it on a loop for an hour at the S10 event. So, but like Samsung doesn't do this, like, let's just stick with the same form factor and like throw newer parts in it. They make new form factors and they use like slightly lower quality parts to bring the price down. And I think part of that is because Samsung knows that the way that they're going to sell their inexpensive phones is to get carriers to push them. The end. There's like, they don't have the marketing infrastructure to say, this is the Galaxy A series, you want it. Like no one, right? That's not how that works. Whereas Apple could be like, it's an iPhone and ba-da-ba, right?
Yeah. All right, let's talk about this camera. I have developed a conspiracy theory about the camera.
Well, that is what the Vergecast is for.
Of course. So as with all phone reviews, there was a flurry of activity on a Sunday afternoon as Dieter uploaded full res shots to a Lightroom album, and then everyone slacked and yelled about them. Those are the good days. That's the good stuff. Here, like Dieter said, what we noticed was in bright light, phone holds up, looks mm-hmm. a lot like an iPhone 11. It might be a little bit warmer.
Yeah, just depending like a hair.
On. Yeah, depending. The light goes away, the thing starts to fall apart.
Yep.
No night mode. But if this is indeed the same sensor as the iPhone XR, mm-hmm. which all of us seem to think it is,
yeah,
that makes no sense. It means that it's gimped in software. It means they just didn't. They took the feature out.
Maybe it might be a smaller sensor.
The XR HDR did not look like the 11 HDR, but this right. looks like the 11.
Yeah.
So they definitely like changed some software tuning on that side.
But so Apple's claim is that the A13 allows them to do things that they couldn't do on the XR or, you know, other 4.7 inch series phones, whatever. So they have this phrase like monocular something, something. And really, that it doesn't actually refer to anything technical. It's just the word they use that says you can get portrait mode out of a single lens. And it's straight up machine learning. They like trained it on a bunch of models and like, here you go. They're not doing like the you know, the weird pixel depth thing that the Pixel phone does. And to me, like if you're able to use your A13 to like get portrait mode, and in some cases the portrait mode and like also the HDR stuff on the SE is like totally respectable, like pretty good. Why are you able to do that and not the night mode? Like what's holding you back? Is it the size of the sensor? Is it you just didn't feel like? I mean, obviously they would have felt like it. I got to think it's like sensor size. The other interesting thing is the SE does not support deep fusion. Mm. So you don't get sweater mode on.
No sweater mode.
The sweater mode, the most insanely hyped, hard to see camera improvement in history, as far as I can tell.
They should call it gaslight mode.
Like, I don't know if it, they told us they turned it on. Mm-hmm. It was like a big deal when they were telling us they were turning it on.
This is a bit of a tangent. One thing I really appreciated was the iPhone SE versus SE, the 2016 versus 2020.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's an outdoor, well-lit shot. And I don't know, it was just cool to see, because like most of these, you know, reviews that The Verge does is comparing flagship versus flagship or like versus like. But this is like 4 years of progress. Like outdoor camera photos have been pretty dang good for 5 years, but they've clearly gotten better. And it's just kind of cool to see.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing, like they're both, you know, whatever the megapixels are, but the old SE, the new SE, the thing that really struck me was how big the advance in HDR was. The sky on the original SE was like a neon aquamarine. And like, no, it should just be blue. And like the new SE got it.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's for $400. It is absolutely impressive. I think the question is a Pixel 4a will come out. It will be around this. It will probably look just like a Pixel.
Well, and so the Pixel 4a and like the Samsung Galaxy A51 or whatever it is, like we didn't just like anoint this thing the best phone under $500, just, you know, because we know those other things are coming real soon and we want to be able to actually test these things head to head. So that's coming. I can tell you what I think is going to happen, but...
What I think is going to happen is Google is not afraid to limit its camera's features to the high-end phone because they don't care who buys a Pixel phone. They just need anyone to buy them.
Yeah.
any plus Pixel sale is a good one. So you might as well just put all the features down there. Whereas I think there's a certain element of Apple, you know, pricing you up to the iPhone 11.
So that's your conspiracy theory, is they held back night mode?
They held, yeah. I think if they want it, night mode is like not a deeply complicated thing to do, right? They just take a bunch of exposures and then the A13 is there to merge them together. I don't think that is incredibly sensor dependent. And I know that it's not because Google just buys like whatever sensors on sale at Walgreens and they like do it. it's like very obvious. So like, yeah, I think there's an element here. It's like the world's weakest conspiracy theory. Like cheapest phone does not have some features. Yeah, that's probably true. But when you just sort of add up the part spin, you're like, I bet someone's going to jailbreak this phone and tell the operating system it's actually an iPhone XR and like unlocks it. The XR doesn't have night mode, by the way. You have to like use Neural Cam, but it didn't have an A13.
They're slowing down the photons in software.
Yeah. That's called a photonic speed reduction that Apple does to really, yeah, it's a weak conspiracy theory, but it does feel like there's some holdbacks in the software that are not directly related to the raw capability of the thing. But look, everyone's going to buy one. Like I assume this will be one of Apple's most popular phones.
For a couple of years. Yeah. Until they like don't update it again for, you know, 5 or 6 years or however long it was since the original SE, and then they'll do it again.
Well, what? One quick question. How'd you feel going back to like a fingerprint sensor on the front? Bit of a throwback.
It was great. I missed it. Yeah, like it's weird because you have to like tap the notification and then tap the fingerprint sensor, whereas with Face Unlock, you can just go right into the app by tapping the notification. But like, I mean, you know, how long have we been using physical home buttons? I still use like on-screen home or, you know, fingerprint sensors on Android phones. So none of that felt unnatural to me. And, you know, like I didn't want to make a big thing of this because the pandemic will end, but I didn't have to type in my passcode as much.
Yeah, that is a really bizarre moment that's happening right now. And Joanna pointed out the same thing in her review. I think Marquez pointed out the same thing in her review. By the way, you should go watch the video that Joanna Stern made for the Wall Street Journal. I mean, look, I love her and she's one of my friends. I'm just deeply worried about where the state of her mind. It's an anthropomorphized phone with lightning cables for arms that lifts AirPods as weights. That is an accurate description of the video that she made.
Yeah.
That is just dead on correct. The phone has self-esteem issues.
Not an inaccurate description of the iPhone SE itself. Because there's no headphone jack. You gotta get AirPods.
All right. Mm-hmm. Dieter, you reviewed, we said the audience was more interested in the keyboard than we talked about. Magic Keyboard, man. It's here.
Yeah.
And then Phil Esposito, we got to call this out. Phil Esposito, Verge Radio Director, first byline on the site, reviewed the Logitech version for the other iPads.
Yeah, the Logitech version in some ways is more interesting because you can separate the keyboard and still have a kickstand, so you can still use it. Hmm. And also, it has a function row. So
interesting,
but it's not made of gold like the Magic Keyboard.
Yeah, it's heavy. I actually finally just got my 11-inch, and I haven't weighed it yet. I got to do that. But the 12.9-inch with the Magic Keyboard attached to it weighs basically exactly the same, like within an ounce or two of a 13-inch MacBook Pro. Weighs more than a MacBook Air. And that, in a way, kind of tells you the whole story. In a very strange way, the Magic Keyboard is not designed for portability. It's designed to sit on a desk or sit at your home on your lap, and it, you know, it doesn't have very good viewing angles. It can only go back to 130, which doesn't seem like much, but like every degree matters when you're tilting it back in terms of like your comfort and your ergonomics. And yeah, it's like they wanted to make like a, it's like more like a keyboard dock than it is a keyboard case, if that makes sense. It's the sort of thing where if I just leave this thing on my desk plugged into the little, you know, USB pass-through charger, and I use it when I'm at my desk. And then when I want to like use my iPad, I can lift it off really easily. And then I get to use my iPad without a case on it again, which is lovely. I love it.
Right? This is what I've been saying. The iPad is this beautiful device when you're just wandering around, like having ideas and jotting them down, like on the go somehow.
Where are you going, Paul?
I don't know. It just feels really cool. I was telling you guys, I was doing music like that. I was walking around my house wearing headphones, making music on the... Anyways, it's so light and portable outside of a case. Even the older case, you know, it's a revelation. Try it.
Well, so this is like, you know, my Dieter, what is a computer thing? Like, what does this do to increase the iPad's essence as an iPad? Or does it make the iPad a computer? Does it make it a laptop? What does it do? It makes it a laptop. Like, it makes it like a big, heavy, you know, you can only use it in a clamshell form factor laptop. That's what it does. But it enables the other iPad stuff that you want to do with an iPad because it makes it easy to pull the iPad off of it. So, like, the best thing about the Magic Keyboard is that it makes it easy not to use the Magic Keyboard.
Doesn't sound like a ringing endorsement, but I'm hearing that as a ringing endorsement.
But again, that's mean because, like, the keyboard itself is great. Like, the typing experience is good. The trackpad experience is good. The backlight is good, even though you can't adjust it manually unless you go into the settings, like four settings deep. As a physical piece of hardware, it is very expensive and it is very good, and it should very much sit on your desk. And yeah.
How is it? I know you don't know the answer because planes are illegal now. Is it going to be good on a plane?
I don't see why it wouldn't. Because the way that it, you know, it like pushes the iPad forward, you mm-hmm. know? With that double hinge system. And that means it's less likely to get caught and smashed on when the seat in front of you leans back. And it also, I mean, I think the real reason they did it was to like center the gravity a little bit. So it's a little bit less tippy and they didn't have to do as much heavy work on like the hinge. So that makes sense. But on a plane, yeah, I think it'll make sense because it'll be about the same in terms of like positioning as maybe even the smart keyboard. It'll just be raised up a little bit.
No, but see, that's the issue. The smart keyboard doesn't go back far enough.
Oh, yeah. This won't go back far enough either. Like, you know, again, 130. That's all you get.
I feel like it's like we've gone from...
Oh, wait.
From...
Hang on. Back up. I'm sorry. Do you use the tray table?
Yes.
Okay. Just making sure. Because when you said it didn't go back far enough, I was a little bit confused.
I find myself on a plane almost always hunched. Like, it's like I'm over the computer, right? That's just like the... Because you're in coach, you got the tray table out, the person's leaned back, and you just sort of end up in this place where you're just more vertically over the computer. You're not sitting back and looking at it. So I need that screen to almost be perpendicular. And like a laptop will do that just fine. An iPad in the regular keyboard case is like, they just didn't think that people would use it on planes. Like, so if you can't go back farther than that, it kills my dream of using the iPad on a plane.
I mean, the thing that I want to tell everybody to do is you don't know if like you would love this thing unless you know two things. One, like, do you want to spend the money on this? Because it's so expensive. But two, like, you need to physically go look at it and hold it and pick it up. Be like, is this heavy? This is okay. Does the screen tilt back enough far enough for me? Yes, no. And then it's a very easy decision. But I like have to like describe it to you because you can't go to an Apple store to try it. Mm.
And who's going on a plane anyway? Come
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
Speaking of describing things that are difficult to describe, can you describe the trackpad more? Because this is Apple's first tiny taptic or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
Touchpad, right?
So it is a real physical button, I think. But you can click anywhere on it, not just at the bottom like you can on a Surface. I think it's great. It feels good. It's glass. You know, you can hear it. It's good.
But it's not like a haptic thing. It's physical. It's moving.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I'm moving it. Yeah.
It's interesting they don't get with like the thinner haptic thing there. I bet that's way more expensive.
Yeah, it's gotta be price. And actually, I don't know that the haptic thing is that much thinner. I don't know. It might take it more power. There's a whole thing that where I haven't done the full test of like, does this thing drain the iPad in standby mode? There's a concern that it might, but I haven't noticed that myself. But I'm going to be running some tests on that next. There's a theory going around the internet right now.
And you didn't feel like it was too small to get around?
What do you mean? Oh, no. I mean...
The physical size of it? Because like sometimes on some Windows laptops that have the tiny touchpads, like a lot of Surfaces have felt like this to me. It's like, yeah, this is not as much as I want to work with.
I'm the guy that moves the acceleration on the trackpad to the max on every single computer. And I'm also the guy that turns on hot corners on the Mac. And so, like, if I hand my computer to somebody, I know it's safe because as soon as they do anything, the Windows will fly everywhere. It's great. So
the question in your review was, is what you want to turn your iPad into a laptop? That gets away from the iPad's strengths, but it appears that everybody wants the iPad to be a laptop. And then the other case, right, the Phil reviewed, the Logitech Combo Touch, like basically just turns iPads into laptops, full stop. Like it has, it's more of a Surface than the Magic Keyboard.
The other thing that's in my review is the pretty trolly comparison to the Surface Pro X. But it's not that trolly. Like, I do take it seriously. The Surface has been, you know, Microsoft has been working on this design for years and years and years, and it was designed from the jump to feel like it has a keyboard attached to it. So, and it actually sucks without a keyboard attached to it, frankly. But this iPad Pro design with the smart connector on the back, which necessitates like a big heavy thing on the back with like magnets and stuff to click onto it, just makes this thing necessarily thicker and heavier. And it's sort of like, I feel like there must be like some fight where like somebody inside the iPad team doesn't want anybody to attach a keyboard to their beautiful tablets. Mm-hmm. And so they like, they purposely design it so that like attaching a keyboard to it is awkward.
Well, just because the Surface solution is a kickstand.
Right. It's a kickstand and it's a smart connector on the bottom, which is, you know, there was a smart connector on the bottom on the previous iPads, but
there's just a part of me that says the end result of this is Apple gives up and makes a laptop that runs iPad OS.
It's possible.
They're just veering towards it so hard. Mm-hmm. Apple's not the kind of company that like half steps it too much.
But if you had a laptop that ran iPad OS, you couldn't rip it away and have it just be an iPad for a while.
But if you have an iPad in almost any one of these, Dieter's point about the Magic Keyboard, like you can just take it off and go.
Yeah.
I think that was like a design priority for them because you get your iPad back. But every one of their other cases, the previous smart keyboard Folio that I have for my iPad Pro, that thing, it just lives in there. You never take that out of there. The thing lives in landscape and it lives in its keyboard dock.
When you get your iPad back, it's great because you've got this thin little iPad, but then it turns out you want to like set it somewhere and watch a movie and you're screwed because there's no kickstand.
Or any amount of typing.
Yeah.
Right, like the entire iPad creativity versus consumption, blah, blah, blah debate is like typing is bad on the iPad.
When you are freestyling an iPad, what's your guys?
Oh my God.
What's your go-to method? Because I've been trying the split keyboard.
No.
And it really breaks my brain. You can basically take what's like an iPhone keyboard and have it split into the two corners. And it just doesn't work for some reason.
I mean, this gets really terrible. So I'm trying the thumb swipe board, but it's not very good. And I've also Twitter and Slack. That's like my go-to split screen. One of those two, like when the auto suggestion bar pops up at the bottom, it covers up the bottom part of the app. So I've turned all of the auto suggestions off because that makes that bar go away, which is great when I have a keyboard attached. But then when I don't and I want to use a software keyboard, I have like zero affordances for typos. I have to get it exactly right. So my go-to move is I use it in portrait.
That really illustrates, like, I've had that tension before where I set up my iPad a little bit in a keyboardy way. Like I was into just as a hobby trying to code on it and get like a terminal running and stuff like that. And yeah, you kind of start making these settings and then like, yeah, you use it away from a keyboard and I'm like, well, this doesn't work anymore.
So the Neil, you bringing up like they're running pell mell into making an iOS laptop. I would like that to be a 360 hinge laptop, but that's a different discussion. They are also, according to Mark Gurman at Bloomberg, definitely developing that ARM processor for the Mac, and it might come out in 2021.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And Gurman's report, you know, he suggests that it will happen at the lower end. Like the dream I have is, you know, Apple has the event, and I don't know.
That's the whole dream, by the way. Apple has the event. We get to go to.
It's a small set of dreams lately. Yeah, I leave my house. That's dream one. No, you know, like Apple has an event, and Tom Boger comes out. He's the guy who does all the Mac intros lately, and he's like, here's the new 11-inch MacBook Air. It has 8-core ARM processor, the Apple A29, whatever it's going to be. And you're like, bah, 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 head explodes. It's amazing. Battery lasts for 45 years. Adobe apps are slow, but one day we'll get there. Right? Like, whatever. It's the thing. It's the Mac. It's the, right? Because they can't do it in the Mac Pro. They can't do it in the MacBook Pro. They still need all the additional horsepower that Intel has. But they can do it on the small one. So you do it on the Air. Like, okay, here it is, done. And then like Tim Cook is like, but there's one more thing. And then Phil Schiller comes out and he's like, screw you, Boger. I don't know why we're so hostile. I haven't been to an Apple event in a while. It's like very clear. But Phil Schiller comes out. He's like, screw you, Tom. Here's the new iPad laptop, iPad book or whatever they call it. And it's like the same processor running iPad OS.
Yeah. And then, Craig Federighi comes out and he says, it's a Mac running an ARM processor. It's an iPad running an ARM processor. It's a Mac running an ARM processor. It's an iPad running an ARM processor. Are you getting it? They're the same thing. And then he reveals that there's just a switch and you could just like hit a physical switch to switch between them.
And there's a kickstand and there's a headphone jack. No.
Craig Federighi comes out and he's like, and you can buy whichever one you want. Good night, everybody. We have absolutely refused to reconcile these two things. But that's where they're headed, right? They're headed into a ultra portable Mac with an ARM processor that runs Mac OS.
Yeah.
That doesn't have a touchscreen. And just sort of necessarily, Microsoft had to do this with the Surface. Eventually, they just made a laptop.
Yeah.
Because the form factor of a laptop is better when you put the weight on the bottom part.
What if you could go into a split screen mode a la iPad on your ARM Mac and it's half Mac, half ARM?
It also runs Android. Like, what are you? I get it. I'm just saying, like, they are cruising towards that moment, probably a little bit less hostile than the one act play that I've just written. Mm. Although, Apple keynote team, if you want to talk to me about how to spice up these events, I got nothing but time.
Kind of reminding me of like a youth group skit.
Thanks, Paul. Wow. It's the harshest burn that's ever been delivered.
I'm so excited for our Mac. It's going to be, we've been so held back. Like it feels like laptops have been at a snail's pace for 3 or 4 years because Intel can't ship a better, like a generationally better processor. And this could, at least in this first form factor, could totally be that. And I'm so excited. I don't know. I really can't. I don't think there's going to be an iPad laptop. It sounds just like a thought crime in Apple's mind. but an ARM Mac sounds like such a good idea, and I'm so stoked.
Well, so, I mean, assuming they can engineer these things with everybody working at home, they can light up their supply chains. 2021 sounds great. We'll see. One more product. We talk about Surface. Microsoft's getting ready to launch a Surface Book 3 and a Surface Go 2.
Yeah.
I would say the laptop form factor wars are like in full swing right now.
Yeah. You guys know that I love the Surface Go. It's near to my heart. It's so small and cute and tiny. They got to fix those bezels. And I'm very, very, very interested in their thought process on putting an Intel Core M3 inside this thing instead of an ARM processor, because they've got an ARM Surface. And, you know, other than the fact that you can't run half the apps you want to, it's pretty good. So I would think that it would be a perfect fit for the Surface Go. But no, they apparently are going to stick with Intel on that thing.
I didn't realize, and maybe this is just, I'm reading Tom's article here about the Surface Go 2. Microsoft will be offering a model with the Intel Core M3 alongside the typical Intel Pentium Gold option. And I just hadn't realized that Pentium Gold, like they still say it proudly, you know, like
it's
Pentium for senior citizens. Like you get a discount at the diner. Okay, we got to move on.
Last thing. The Surface Book 3 is fascinating because it seems like they're finally putting a new GPU in there that is actually like optimized for pro users and not like, maybe you can game on it. I don't know. It's like, nope, you're buying this to run Adobe. Here you go.
Yeah. I mean, have you guys seen it? Speaking of GPUs, did you see the NVIDIA RTX audio demo this week that was going around?
Oh, very clever.
So good. It's like, why can't I have an NVIDIA graphics card on my Mac? I'll make all the calls sound better. All right, take a break. Be right back.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Wow, that guy means business.
Just an amazing player.
No, not him. The sports photographer behind him.
What?
He has a business bank account with QuickBooks Money where he earns 5% annual percentage yield. So he's scoring big on and off the field. You might even say he's the MVB.
MVB?
The most valuable business.
Making your money work harder. That's how you business differently. Intuit QuickBooks. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Paul Miller.
Hello.
Every week, my friend.
I do a segment, and it's always been called Tap Me on the Shoulder. Okay. Yeah, okay. So I know you're still getting used to the name. So Motorola, I just have to take you through my thought process so you understand where I'm coming from. Motorola has got this new flagship out, the Edge Plus. And it's got these curved sides. The things since the Samsung, was it the Galaxy S8 or whatever? I forget when they started doing this. I've never liked it. I think it's a bad idea. But one of the things that they mentioned as a possibility, and of course you never like buy a phone based on a promise of future software, but that you could use that tapered side for shoulder buttons in a game, right? And obviously, we've been searching the internet over for a true phone gamer. I got a couple mentions on Twitter, but neither of them really. Like one of them, it was clearly a screenshot of a tablet, and the other one just said, "I bought a gamer phone, but not for games." But so you can imagine a gamer phone with a fan inside, and don't do the curved edge screen. That's dumb. Put the Taptic style fingerprint sensor like the iPhone SE has, and then have a good haptics engine inside of your phone so that you can get like tactile feedback when you click. I'm doing all these gestures, but nobody can see. When you click, so just basically good shoulder buttons on a gamer phone, I think would vastly improve gaming on a phone. That's really my whole point.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, haven't you just made a Switch Lite?
Don't they have physical buttons?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Just the squeezy buttons on the side?
Yeah. Buttons that just, they vibrate to let you know you've pressed them, but they're not hard to press. Like, I don't know, I guess. You know what I mean? Like typical side phone buttons are like hard to click. I want like quick buttons for aiming down sights and pulling the trigger.
Yeah, the average quality of haptics on any Android phone is so low that you are basically asking them to like do cold fusion, like give them some time to fix haptics.
LG makes pretty good haptics.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, we've got this Edge Plus. I really want to see if these curved sides are any good and if it's like it's just like accidental touch city. But then Chris Welch just reviewed the V60.
Yeah, it has the second display.
Yeah, if you want, you can get the second display. It's like, what I love about LG is like, okay, so Samsung, they got us beat on prettiness. They're going to have us beat on like build quality and edge to edge, and they're going to have us beat on marketing. So we're not going to do any of that. we're going to make a phone that just does stuff that's like really basic looking, and we'll have a case with a second screen on it and a headphone jack. And I kind of respect it. They're not going to try and take Samsung head on. They're just going to be like, well, we're just going to make our thing. We know that it's not going to set the world on fire. Like the Note did. Yeah, it's like fine. It looks pretty good.
Okay. I mean, Headphone Jack. You know, I'm always interested
with like a high end DAC though. I really want to do like a comparison of like a phone like this versus like my, I guess my dongle for my Pixel is dying anyway, so that's not going to be a good comparison. But the theoretical dongle that used to work.
Vlad used to just like wax poetic about LG's DACs. They're very good. You have to like commit to not streaming low quality Spotify to hear it, but like
right.
Make the commitment, Paul.
Okay, I will.
All right. Jeez.
I won't because I'm not going to buy this. I'm sorry. Well, see, there
you go. You're like, I'm going to keep using my broken Pixel.
Keep trying, model. Guys. Make it smaller next time.
Okay, some things to wrap up on. This one is very important, but not important for a minute. Today, FCC voted, Paul, this is like a classic Paul story, to make a big chunk of 6 gigahertz spectrum unlicensed. So you don't need a license to use it. The last time they did this, I think the FCC freed up the spectrum in like 1989, and then it took like a decade for Wi-Fi to happen. This time, the Wi-Fi people were like ready. So on top of the FCC voting to free up the spectrum, there's a new standard, which is horrifically called Wi-Fi 6E. They came so close. If you remember, like a few months ago, they're like, we got to simplify these Wi-Fi names. It's Wi-Fi 3, 4, 5, and the new one is 6. Now you got 6E.
Yeah.
Which reminds me of nothing so much as AT&T's lie of 5GE. I'm not sure why they wanted to ride that bandwagon. But Wi-Fi 6 is, you know, the new Wi-Fi in the existing 2.4 and 5 gigahertz bands. Wi-Fi 6E operates on the 6 gigahertz band. The amount of spectrum, Jake Kastrakis wrote a great explainer on this. He's been tracking it forever. Basically, it's an enormous amount of spectrum. So the channels can be huge inside of the 6 gigahertz band. Presumably you're going to be able to, as products come out, they'll move off of the 2.4 and 5 gigahertz band onto the wider channels and 6 gigahertz, thus freeing up the old channels. So that's like sort of a knock on improvement. And then because they're big channels, you don't have to do the like channel jumping that you used to have to do. I mean, I think two of the new channels in Wi-Fi 6E, the 6 gigahertz channels, wouldn't even fit in the amount of spectrum allocated for 5 and 2.4.
With the existing Wi-Fi spectrum, between the 2.4 gigahertz area and the 5 gigahertz area, there was like 400 megahertz worth of spectrum. And the new, I can't do this math really quick, but there are 760 megahertz channels in the 6 gigahertz. So 7 times 160. So that's 1220. So like 3x more capacity is in the 6 gigahertz band than was existing in Wi-Fi right now, which sounds amazing. I'm so excited.
Yeah. So what does this mean in sort of like real world terms? They're saying you might be able to get 1 to 2 gigabits down on a Wi-Fi 6 channel, which is incredible. That's like real world to a phone. None of these products exist. Obviously, the Wi-Fi Alliance is like ready to go. Everyone's excited about it. They think the first products are going to be routers and some smartphones. There's already a Qualcomm chip. There's already a Broadcom chip. Intel says it'll have chips in January. So, and then Linksys and Netgear have said it. And then importantly, Apple has, all it says is the FCC's approval sets the course for the next generation of Wi-Fi networks. You can just read into that. Like Apple's doing
airport's
it tomorrow.
Airport's coming back, baby. Airport. The airport's back.
So just super exciting news. It's one of those things where, you know, the policy side of it, the spectrum policy side of it will have sort of immediate repercussions. An important note is the FCC didn't do this for Wi-Fi. They just made the spectrum unlicensed, sort of knowing the Wi-Fi people were ready, but other people can use it too. I think some 5G networks, they're going to use some of the spectrum is like over capacity in some places, which is interesting.
So hang on. If some 5G networks are going to use some of this, would that interfere with Wi-Fi 6E? And if so, you would think that whoever gets it done first would get to use the spectrum. Therefore, it's a race.
I can neither confirm nor deny these reports. I have no comment at this time. There's some like neat stuff that has to happen here, like automatic frequency allocation to avoid some of this interference. It's just neat. Like it's a big, neat idea. that is first a big political decision had to happen. It's taken a long time, but the immediate excitement from sort of the technology community is there. You should read Jake's piece. It really goes into all the weeds of it, but it's something to keep an eye on. And it's funny, every time we write about the nitty-gritty of Wi-Fi or we write about new routers, the audience is absolutely there. It's like one of my favorite Verge quirks. Like, we'd go to CES, you know, in the old times, and we'd be like, look at this router, and like it'd be the most popular post on the site. This is like critical infrastructure now. So the idea that it's going to get better and we're going to get out of the choke points of our existing networks, a big deal.
Can I run a wild idea by you?
Yeah.
So Dish Network has all this spectrum and they're not doing anything with it, right? I looked it up and their market cap is $11 billion right now. That's $33 per US person. If we did the world's largest Kickstarter and we bought Dish, because you know my goal is for the FCC to make all spectrum free and let people do cool things with it and figure it out. I'm sure we could have managed to communicate across the country and across the globe without the FCC like auctioning and spectrum monopolies off. But in lieu of that, we buy Dish and we just make all of its spectrum free.
I love that we're the idea here in its most reductive form is, what if we buy out Dish, which is run by a single person, Charlie Ergen, who's been hoarding the spectrum and doesn't know how to use it, but still effectively a dictator of the spectrum. And what we're going to do is replace it with everyone in America owning one tiny slice of it. And we'll somehow make that a more effective decision-making process.
We would own it under, but we would release it under a permissive license.
Well, we would need to form some sort of organization to maintain and run it. Yeah.
Like a communications.
No, just let people and fire
radios. We would run it together. Maybe we like
a federation.
Vote. So yeah. Or like, I don't know, like a society, like we would socialize it is what Paul is suggesting.
You don't have to do that with Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi is open for business is what I like to say.
Okay.
There's literally they're called the Wi-Fi Alliance.
Yeah, for Wi-Fi, but I could go and come up with the Paul Alliance. And the Paul Alliance is going to make a very similar spec that's slightly and implausibly incompatible. And I can do that because 2.4 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz.
Oh my God, do you hear that sound? I got an email. Qualcomm is supporting the Paul Alliance. Qualcomm bets business on Paul Alliance. It's amazing. Paul, I hear what you're saying. Like, there's a reason there's been this push to open up the spectrum. I think what you don't want is to like knock out every cell tower in America because one guy decided that he was going to blast 700 megahertz signals out. That's the problem.
Right. The thing I want, like the big upshot I want to live in a world where I could move to a neighborhood and a neighborhood could like band together and like, hey, we've got bad cell phone signal here. Let's build a tower. And now we have our own tower and we have the best cell phone service in the world. Like, I want that kind of scenario.
That exact thing that you are describing is why cable television was called Cat TV for a long time, because they called it community access television. Mm. And so the neighbors would band together. They would buy a satellite dish. They would pick up the satellite signals from the big broadcasters using like big C-band dishes and then physically run cables to all of their houses. That is the genesis of cable television in this country, is like just a bunch of people. Like Ted Turner was like a cowboy who just like ran some cables up a hill and then he like blustered his way into like Turner Networks. I'm with you. I just think it's harder with wireless because it interferes. But I take your point. By the way, if you ever want to read about the history of cable, like I think it's a Susan Crawford book. I'll figure out what it is. I'll tweet out. But like, it is a bunch of renegades and misfits who just like took on the broadcast networks and were like, well, you don't have antennas near us, so we're going to do it ourselves. It's neat. I feel like I have to disclose that Comcast is an investor in Fox Media. that's also how Comcast started. Okay, speaking of cable and streaming wars, just some stuff to run through. It is earnings season. We're actually paying extra close attention to earnings right now because of the virus. We you know, the companies we follow closely are obviously impacted. Streaming stuff, Snapchat, doing great in isolation. Snapchat use is way up with everybody home. Their ad revenues are up. That's super interesting. Netflix added 15 million subscribers. They're warning, though, that they're going to, quote, pause on product innovation because they just need to support the amount of use that's happening. Tiger King is as popular as Stranger Things. It's like one of their big hits. Julia had this great tweet where, like, Reed Hastings and Ted Sarandos, the head of content at Netflix, were doing their earnings call. And they're like, look at our list of top tens. It's all Netflix originals. And Julia was like, well, you buy them, you program the algorithm, you show them and recommend. Like, of course it's the stuff that you want. This is an insane top 10 list. Like, this doesn't map to anything.
And I don't know. I'm at the point where if I want to watch a movie, turns out I'm paying $4. Like, because I try to ideate movies. Like, I'm living here with my sister. We try to come up with what do we want to watch? And we think about it. We go over our various want to watch lists. And then I go on justwatch.com and it's always $4. Like, the amount of good movies that seem to land on these streaming services just seems like, I don't know, it seems like it's vanishing.
It's absolutely vanishing because they're all the studios are pulling back for their own streaming services, which leads to the next thing. HBO Max is launching on May 27th. NBC Universal's Peacock is launching. I'll just disclose it again. Peacock is owned by Comcast, blah, 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 blah. There's the best relationship there. You already know. Peacock seems... Right. They're betting heavily on some of their archive stuff. They're betting heavily that it's NBC. That sort of makes sense. We're going to keep an eye on it. It's rolling out to like Xfinity X1 customers first, and then there's a wider launch later. So they're doing it in phases. They're not going to have that big Disney Plus moment. HBO Max, the launch seems insane. Like, it is impossible to, if you just like read their webpage, and I encourage you to go do it, but halfway through, you just lose all sense of time and space. You're like, what is HBO? Does it come with this? I'm unclear. It's bundled with like half of AT&T's plans, but not the other half. A quarter of AT&T's plans get like a couple months free trial. It makes these weird references to how it uses your wireless data, and then your wireless data might get throttled. And it's like,
what?
You didn't remember to zero rate your own service? That makes no sense. It is just crazy. So we'll have Julia on next week or the week after, because this stuff is launching and literally she's the only person who understands it. But HBO, the thing with Westworld, that's gonna remain. It's like unchanged. HBO Max is like a streaming service that has HBO in it and then a bunch of weird other stuff, like teen dramas and a Snapchat interface and like Friends. And that's the thing that you pay for. So if you already have HBO, you don't get HBO Max unless something else, you subscribe to some other AT&T thing. I think this is hopelessly confused. And to me, it's like they put out a press release and the guy, Greenblatt, who runs HBO Max, is like, we're so excited to have AT&T as our strategic distribution partner. And it's like, dude, AT&T owns you. Like, if they turned you down, you should run.
Isn't this like that, you know, like there's a thing in tech where product development kind of follows the organizational structure?
Yeah, you ship your org chart. That's a Steven Sinofsky quote.
Okay. Is that what's happening here?
Yes.
It seems like no one, AT&T is a huge, yes. I think the answer is yes, but I think it's like worse. AT&T is a huge diffuse organization, right? They run DirecTV. They run another television streaming service, which is called, I shit you not, AT&T TV Now Max. Yep. I don't know what that is. That's just another thing that they make. They run UVerse. They run, obviously, AT&T Wireless. They now own Warner. Part of Warner is HBO. HBO runs HBO Max, but that's run by... They own CNN. Is that part of all... Who knows, right? Like, it's this massive conglomerate. And usually in, like, the ship your org chart scenario, all of your, like, little department heads are little fiefdoms, right? They're, like, power centers, and then the product represents that clash between power centers and everybody's represented. Here it's like, I don't think anybody understands AT&T. And so it's just like this muddle of ideas that isn't focused into one thing.
So like someone tried to draw the org chart, but then someone came by and like accidentally smudged it. And then they shipped that.
It's just super confusing. This one, it just feels like it will be the one that, it's your point about mergers, Paul. It's like, you can just wait them out because anything of this size and scale and ego will just eat itself. But anyway, it's launching. We're going to see if you can make heads or tails of that website. Please let me know. Otherwise, I'm just going to keep pestering Julia.
And AT&T, if you're looking to offload some spectrum and you want a fair price.
The Paul Alliance is waiting. A few more other little things. Fandango just bought... It's another disclosure. Fandango is owned by Comcast.
Really?
Yeah. Fandango just bought Vudu from Walmart. So I'm a Vudu stan. I think this is great.
The best thing about Walmart owning Vudu is Walmart didn't know what to do with Vudu, so they left it alone. And Vudu was just like, oh, well, our niche is like making the best, offering the best quality stream. So we're just going to do that until Walmart notices that it costs a lot of money to do that. And like Fandango, like, have you used Fandango? Have you like interacted with that product ever?
Yes. And I understand why they bought Vudu.
Yeah. I am just super worried about meddling. I am super worried that they're going to Fandango up Vudu, and that is the last thing Vudu needs.
Yeah, and there's like the element of the conglomerate, right? They're owned by NBC Universal. Will Universal take advantage of having a distribution service? We'll see.
Will Disney get mad that Universal owns this other thing and like not offer their movies for rent on this service?
Yeah, it's a lot. And the reason I was a Vudu stan is they had the Marvel movies in 4K HDR and iTunes did not. Right. And so if you wanted to watch the Marvel movie with all the lights, you became a Vudu stan. So we'll see if that continues. But that's like a good niche for them. Sonos launched a streaming radio service, which is really interesting. It's all free. It's like a default service. Like you just plug in the Sonos and it's the thing that works. They're doing it out of the basement of their like New York office, which I think is pretty funny. They kind of said they would never do this. I think this is the beginning of a service offering from Sonos. It's also like, if you look at the Roku model, this is how Roku makes its money. There's the Roku channel, which I never think about. I'm assuming most people don't think about. It's like the heart of their money is like ad-supported content on Roku, on the Roku channel and around the interface. So we'll see. That happened. Another little move. There's just more. Stream wars are off and running, even though everyone's in isolation. Samsung smart TVs are getting Apple Music app, which I think is utterly bizarre. Like, why? Like, who wants to sit and click around with your Samsung remote to use a music app?
There must be people. I mean, there's demand for it, right? So they made it. And also...
But Samsung smart TVs have AirPlay 2. You can just do it on your phone and send it to TV.
Well, you know, sometimes maybe not everybody that owns a Samsung TV has an iPhone. Mm. Maybe there's a bunch of Android users.
And yet they subscribe to Apple Music. Apple Music also hit the web this week. Like they're going fully horizontal with Apple Music, which I think is interesting.
They've already done the work to bring Apple TV to Samsung TVs, and they've done the work to bring Apple Music to the web. That effort is probably related. A bunch of smart TV apps are just web apps anyway.
Yeah, but Apple doesn't do it because they can. They usually have some strategic reason. And maybe they realize like a bunch of people are signing up for Spotify on their Tizen TVs. Like I would love to see that spreadsheet that's like the growing threat of Tizen. Like,
well, but like Apple Music, they showed up on all these TVs at like two CESs ago. Or Apple TV showed up on a bunch of TVs two CESs ago. Apple Music has been on Android forever. It just, if there's an un-Apple division of Apple, it feels like that's kind of it. They're just like, yeah, we're just going to keep doing our thing. We're going to make ourselves available on other platforms. And like that division of Apple feels more like AT&T or like another like music service than any other part of Apple.
Well, I mean, that division of Apple was Beats. So in many ways it is. Last one, I just want to call it out because it's something we've been paying attention to a lot. Google Duo, their video call app, they're saying quality will improve because they're using the AV1 video codec now, which is like the thing we've been waiting for, because when AV1 rolls out wide, it means finally YouTube and 4K and Apple devices. Right? It's the consort, like Apple and Google, like they all came together and made their next generation video codec. So using it in Duo is like, it's the first little test shot. We'll see. We'll see if that means, but it's interesting to me that Google's shipping AV1 in a product now. So that's it. That was our stream. We got to have Julia on to walk through it, especially HBO Max. Figuring out who gets HBO Max for free is so much more complicated than it should be, because the answer should be everyone who has an AT&T account, right? But you would be wrong.
Or no one.
By the way, do you know what an AT&T U450 account is?
Nope.
Because if you do, you get HBO Max for free.
Oh, my God.
I think it's a U-verse account. It's just crazy. So we'll have Julia on soon to walk us through this next round of Stream Wars, because between HBO Max, between Peacock, between Netflix is like it's here. It's big news. And we got to check in on Disney, which is like in a weird place right now.
Super weird place.
So there's no one better to talk about Disney than Julia. But we'll do that in the weeks to come. We're done for now. That was the Vergecast. You can tweet at me. I'm at Reckless. You can tweet at Paul, Future Paul, Dieter Spacklon. You can subscribe to Homescreen, which is TC Sodic's new newsletter about fun things, which I know people want. You can subscribe to Dieter's newsletter, Processor, which is about computers. And you subscribe to The Interface with Casey Newton. In the feed right now, Interface Live event, Casey interviewing Sarah Fry from Bloomberg about her book, No Filter, The Inside Story of Instagram. That was a great conversation. We'll be back on Tuesday with The Interview Show, back on Friday with Chat Show. That's it. It's Vergecast. Rock and roll.
Paul.
Promo code.
Support for this show comes from Fundrise. Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/fox. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
Support for this show comes from Vanta. Dealing with loads of spreadsheets, juggling different tools, and having to do manual security checks, it can be a headache to keep up with today's compliance and security programs. Vanta is the trust management platform that wants to simplify things and bring all your trust-building efforts under one roof, making growth smoother for your whole organization. Vanta lets you automate up to 90% of compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, HIPAA, and more, strengthen security posture, and reduce third-party risk. Get $1,000 off Vanta when you go to vanta.com/vox. That's VANTA.com/vox for $1,000 off Vanta.